Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Zachary Lawthorne from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, my Vice Chair Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. First item on our agenda is Senate Bill 247, Generated Obscene Child Sex Abuse Material, sponsored by Senator Keel. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Keel and his staff, James Oglesby. Please join us in the front. Put yourselves on the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel. I have the great privilege of serving as the Senator for District B. With me this afternoon is James Oglesby, the University of Alaska Ted Stevens Foundation intern, who has been working in my office this year and my primary staffer on this legislation. I'll take the liberty, Mr. Chairman, of saying this maybe the last hearing I get to work with Mr. Oglesby, and I have a lot of catching up to do. He's good.
Note Senator Tobin joined us at 1:31.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 247 deals with, you will hear people call it AICSAM. What are we talking about? The initials stand for artificial intelligence generated child sexual abuse material. Once upon a time, we called this material child pornography, but that's the wrong name, and we changed it in law a few years ago. These are images of children who are being subjected to sexual assault. With the explosion of artificial intelligence, image-generating and image-modifying tools, we are also seeing tremendous growth in these terrible materials. They range from modifications of still photos to digital collages that look like genuine video of individuals, in this case minors, engaged in these behaviors that can be indistinguishable, or at the rate of change in the industry, very soon will be indistinguishable from actual video. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 247 amends Alaska law to create parity between these generated child sexual abuse materials and non-generated, actual photographs, actual video of identifiable individual children being abused in these ways. It creates the crimes of possession and separately of distribution of generated child sexual abuse material that applies, these new crimes apply where the subject depicted is not individually identifiable as an actual child. It also reinforces our current CSAM laws by applying what's called the Miller test. That's the test that the United States Supreme Court articulated to determine what is obscene to these generated images. So the First Amendment has never applied to videos and to images of actual identifiable children being subjected to this, to these behaviors. In the case of these generated materials, whether modified or generated from whole cloth, we would subject them to that Miller test. They must be obscene to be prosecutable under these two new crimes. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 247 sets the punishments for the generated child sexual abuse material crimes on par, level, with the non-generated child sexual abuse material crimes. That avoids overburdening Alaska law enforcement with the intensive use of resources that it would take to, in each and every case, in each and every image, determine whether we have an unmodified image of an actual child or perhaps just a very slightly modified image. The tool that is used to identify actual children, known videos that have been proven in the past, is what's called a digital hash. think of it like a digital fingerprint. That's maybe a little inapt, but it's a good metaphor, a good simile. With a little modification, you don't have the same digital hash. To avoid spending endless resources on proving which situation applies when you have obscene material that depicts a child being subjected to the behaviors in the bill, this sets the penalties equal to one another. So the accountability comes either way. We can focus simply on guilt or innocence rather than intensive bargaining and work over precisely which penalty would apply. A couple of other minor elements of the bill, Mr. Chairman. It does protect those folks in the tech industry whose job it is to try and catch and route out this stuff. You will not be prosecuted if you work for instance, a telecom or an internet service provider, and you possess generated child sexual abuse material in the course of your work for the purpose of getting rid of it or keeping it off your network or reporting it to law enforcement. and then finally, Mr. Chairman, in the prior committee, a change was made to the sexual behaviors that are covered under both our status quo child sexual abuse material law and this generated CSAM law to include an Mr. Chairman, I always apologize with bills like these. Sometimes the conversations get uncomfortable. But we have to talk about what's in the bill. To include subjecting a child to contact with semen, which was not previously one of the things that, if depicted, would be child sexual abuse material. You'll find that addition on page 3 of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Oglesby reminds me the other change made in the Community Regional Affairs Committee is that the possession and distribution of generated child sexual abuse material will also be a registrable sex offense. Again, an element of parity with the pre-existing crimes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. That is the gist of the bill. Mr. Oglesby is available for questions. I believe we also have some invited testifiers.
And I would note that available for questions is Nathan Bucknell from Department of Public Safety, who's online. I know there's a sectional analysis, but we will probably forego the sectional analysis. And Senator Tobin, question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. Senator Keel, the first is around Section 10, and I apologize as I don't know the correct terminology, so I'm going to use terminology I know, which is around mandated reporting. And I see this exempts an employee or contractor solely for the purposes of to prevent, detect, report. But what is the mandate that they are required to report? What is the trigger that if they do find these materials that they have to tell the authorities?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Tobin's question, this bill does not make any change in Alaska's mandatory reporting statutes. And I will need to research and find out whether possession or distribution of this material triggers mandatory reporting. I can tell you that if someone subject to Alaska's mandatory reporting laws is aware that a child is being subjected to the behaviors in question, that must be reported. I will find out as to awareness of the possession or distribution of the images. I don't have that at my fingertips.
Thank you. And a second question, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize if this is not the purview of the bill. It's just something that I've recently read in the Department of Education and Early Development's recent statewide bullying report, that there are instances where these types of materials are being shared among students, being promulgated in student bodies. And yet I do see a zero fiscal note from them. And there has been and continues to be reports of this type of bullying activity. And so I'm just curious in terms of this particular legislation, what do we think the impact will be in schools, particularly for those 17, 18-year-olds or potentially even 16, 15-year-olds who might be engaged in this behavior in the education space?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Tobin, it's important that we keep in mind as we think about this bill that these are pictures, these are videos, the content of which is functionally, you should think of as being illegal content, right? If the only difference between it being legal or illegal is whether an actual child is depicted or whether a generated or modified image of a child is the depiction, it doesn't change the conduct that's being shown. You still have a minor being subjected to acts to which they cannot consent. The growth of the problem, especially of modified images, I saw a reference in some of the research materials to what they call nudifying apps, where an image of someone is taken and then the app effectively creates an image as though they wore no clothes. it's very troubling. And it is part of a broader societal issue that we need to continue to work on. The way to deal with childhood bullying is not generally through felony law. However, when you have someone who is distributing these images, when you have people who are profiting from this conduct and these images of children, especially when you're talking about adults and we talk outside the juvenile justice system and into the criminal prosecution side of the arena, that's where these criminal laws should come into play.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Keel.
I don't see any other questions. I know you've got one person here for invited testimony, Trevor Storrs with the Alaska Children's Trust. Mr. Storrs, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, I'd ask you to limit your comments to 3 minutes.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. And for the record, my name is Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust, and we are the statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect. Again, thank you for this opportunity to speak to SB 247. CSAM is the term, as it's been discussed, has replaced child pornography in both common usage and thanks to recent legislative action in the Alaska statute. The Alaska Children's Trust applauds the legislature for updating this language and recognizing that the new terminology more accurately reflects the grave reality of these crimes. The real prevalence of child sex abuse is not known because so many victims don't disclose or report their abuse. However, adult retrospective studies by the CDC show that 1 in 4 women and probably 1 in 6 men were sexually abused before the age of 18. Alaska has one of the highest per capita of child sexual abuse in the nation. Here are some of the statistics for you. Child sexual abuse cases reported by Child Protective Services nearly doubled from 155 in 2015 to a peak of 295 in 2020, before settling around 252 in 2022. And over this period, sexual abuse grew as a share of all child maltreatment cases, rising from 5% in 2015 to about 10% in 2022. From 2013 to 15, 13.7% of Alaska adults reported experienced child sexual abuse. And in 2020, 35% of Alaska women reported experienced sexual abuse when they were a child. AI-generated CSAM represents one of the most urgent and fast-moving threats facing children today. In 2023, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received 4,700 reports of AI-related CSAM. By 2024, that number had grown to 67,000. And in the first half of 2025 alone, they received more than 400,000 such reports, an average of over 2,000 every single day. At the same time, sextortion, which offenders use real or AI-generated images to blackmail children, continues to surge. In 2023, an estimated 186,000 American children were victims of sextortion. And by the first half of 2025, financial sextortion reports to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had nearly doubled compared to the same period the year before. The center is aware of at least 36 teenage boys who have taken their own lives as a result of sextortion. These are not emerging threats on the horizon. They are happening now in our communities to our children. And as we know, Alaska is not immune to the issue. In 2024, an Army soldier stationed at Joint Base Amlendorf-Richardson was arrested in 2024 for creating AI-generated CSAP. This case revealed that Alaska had no state statute addressing it, and the soldier was prosecuted under federal law. And in conversations with law enforcement, extortion is happening to Alaska's children.
Mr. Storrs, you're at about the three-minute mark. If you would conclude your remarks, please.
You bet. This impact is like law, and this is your opportunity to change that. Please support SB 247. And again, on behalf of the Children's Trust, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Storrs? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on this matter. Senator Keel, I know you have finance commitments in another committee. If you need to leave, don't hesitate, because I want to make sure you had a chance. Actually, I'll ask any questions for Senator Keel that hasn't been answered already. All right. Feel free to go to the next committee. I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 247? If you want to come forward. Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed. We limit public testimony to 2 minutes per person.
Good afternoon, Chair Klayman and members of the committee. My name is Rose Feliciano. I am here on behalf of TechNet. I had the opportunity to work with Representative Vance last year on this bill and Senator Keel this year on the bill. Really appreciate the efforts. We support this measure. As you probably know, 45 states have passed similar measures. We appreciate consistency. These bills are important because they catch the bad actors. Provisions that I care about, I'm a tech trade association, is making sure that what we call the search and destroy teams are not considered collecting and distributing. We do have a request. Right now, there's not a provision to protect the email and text. So if you were to text material or email material, all the other states have provisions that say that they're not liable for what a person sends. And we would like to have that language in. I did provide some options to Senator Keel for that. Would like that to be considered. I do want to answer Senator Tobin's question. Federal law requires that media platforms that identify CSAM, they have to report it to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and then they and then they will contact law enforcement. So
a quick question on your comment about the protecting email and text. Do you mean protecting email and text from the group that's protected in Section 10?
So basically that the ISP or the telecom would not be considered distributing or collecting.
Essentially, when they say, here's the image, they send that to law enforcement, that text or email wouldn't be a crime.
Yeah, those are in all the 45 states. So we just want to make sure that we have that in there as well.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Feliciano? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see anyone. Oh, Ms. Stanfill, are you testifying? Please come forward.
That was a rookie mistake. I forgot to put my name there.
That's okay.
Sorry about that.
You're a known participant. Happy to see you. Good afternoon.
You. Brenda Stanfill. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I appreciate the opportunity to support this bill today. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is the federally recognized state coalition of 24 community-based domestic violence and sexual assault service providers across Alaska, and we strongly support SB 247. As was talked about by the bill sponsor, there are two ways that AI imagery is created, from children who do exist and those who do not. Even when AI creates an entirely fictitious child, the material still fuels and normalizes the sexualization of children. It reinforces the same patterns that drive demand for child sexual abuse materials, and it increases risk for real-world abuse. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, offenders frequently move from fantasy material to seeking authentic images. Access to virtual or no-contact abuse material has not reduced demand for real content. It has often fueled it. With the ability to use AI to generate CSAM, this has led to another harmful thing for our children, which is sextortion that you heard Mr. Storrs talk about. Offenders use generated artificial intelligence to create explicit images of a child that are often used as blackmail for additional sexual content, to coerce a child to engage in sexual activity, or oftentimes to obtain money. This has subjected children to embarrassment and shame, impacting their mental health, and in some cases has led to a child taking their own life. We appreciate very much this bill being introduced to ensure that Alaska law is keeping up with the increasing challenges presented by the fast-moving AI technology, and we encourage you to pass this bill out of committee as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify on Senate Bill 247? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to turn online. The first person I have online is Remy Spring. If you would please identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, and your time limit is 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Remy Spring. I oppose the current wording of Senate Bill 247, specifically wording in Section AF 1161-122. Let me state wholeheartedly that I believe children need to be protected. That's not in dispute. Real children are real victims. Under the section concerning possession of generated obscene CSAM, the qualifications for obscenity under the Miller test are listed to define this type of material. But the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Stanley versus Georgia that private possession of obscene materials in one's own home cannot be criminalized. They found it unconstitutional and ruled that obscenity in one's own home is protected under the First Amendment. Additionally, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Ashcroft versus the Free Speech Coalition that virtual child porn, CSAM, including computer-generated images, are protected under the First Amendment, specifically concerning distribution and possession of virtual child pornography that appears to but does not depict real children. It follows, then, that possession of realistic generated AI CSAM that does not involve a real identifiable minor cannot be prosecuted and is actually protected under the First Amendment. With this in mind, this bill would make it illegal to produce any sort of realistic sexual content of something resembling a child, as Section AF 1161-122A2 reads, regardless whether an actual child was used. Given all of this, the current wording of the bill, should it become law, will be grounds for litigation. I will note the Supreme Court did find in Stanley versus Georgia that obscenity is not protected concerning distribution. In conclusion, I urge legislatures to think about their motivation for supporting this bill, amend it accordingly. Is the purpose to prosecute the people who are actually harming children, or is it to just lock up people because they looked at something the general public considers gross but has no victim? If legislatures would like this bill to stand, I suggest shifting the obscenity portion in Section AF 1161-121 concerning distribution into that section. Remove the line regardless of whether
Mr. Spring,
child was used.
Mr. Spring, you're about the two-minute mark. If you would conclude your remarks, please.
I think we need to protect actual victims and prevent prosecutions of someone for fictitious and victimless depictions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we've got Ed Martin. Mr. Martin, if you'll identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Chairman Quayman and members of the committee, very important committee. Today I'd like to speak in favor of Senate Bill 247. The gentleman before me pointed out some issues that may warrant, for whatever reason, some changes, although I support this bill. And I want to commend Senator Keel for doing this. As a great-grandfather of a six-year-old, and a three-year-old great-granddaughter, I'm at an age where I realize that there's a lot of immorality happening in our country more than ever, because it's reported more than ever. These are age-old things that are going on here that we got to do our best so we can protect our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. So I do support this if there's some proper adjustments need to be. I'm certain, and I have faith in this committee to do what's right. So God bless you in your mission and your due diligence with regards to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else online. I'll ask one last time. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one else, we're closing public testimony. Thank you very much. Before we put the bill aside, would Senator Keel or your staff, would you like to make any closing remarks?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Again, for your record, Jesse Keel, Senator for District B. I appreciate very much the public testimony, and I think it's important for the Judiciary Committee to keep in mind that the case of Stanley v. Georgia, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1969, was differentiated in Osborne versus Ohio, decided in 1990. There is not a First Amendment protection for the simple possession of child pornography, which is what it was called then. Again today, child sexual abuse material. I am confident, Mr. Chairman, that were there a challenge to the law proposed, possession of generated child sexual abuse material, and again, has to meet the obscenity test, not just material depicting, but actually meet the three prongs of the Miller test, it will be upheld as an appropriate and valid action of state power.
Thank you. And actually, I'll ask a quick question. There was a question about the emailing and texting with respect to reporting. Is that an amendment that you are aware of and had those discussions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I forgot. We have been in conversations with folks from TechNet. They have proposed some language. We are looking at that proposed language. I'm going to bounce it by the Department of Law. Certainly, there is no intention to criminalize a telecom provider, an internet service provider, who does not know that child sexual abuse material is being transmitted across their networks, whether generated or not. As you noted, there's already a protection for the, I think they were called search and destroy teams, but the white hats, the good actors. We just want to make absolutely certain that any additional language we were to put in the law doesn't carve out a loophole for a bad actor who might make their living transmitting this material. And so, Mr. Chairman, still working on that, happy to include your office in those discussions to make sure it's acceptable to the committee.
And encourage you to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I know you will. All right. I don't see any other questions from the committee. We're going to set this bill aside for further review. The second and last item on our agenda is confirmation hearings. The president referred the following governor's appointment, or actually the governor's appointments on the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Our members should have received the resumes for today's two folks testifying. First, we have Aldean Kilborn. Ms. Kilborn, hold on. Yes, I believe you're
on. Do I go ahead?
Yes, I'm just making sure you're on the phone. Yes, please identify yourself for the record. Make sure you're not on a speakerphone, and please proceed.
All right, thank you. My name is Aldean Kilborn, and I live in Fairbanks. I'm here as a second-term appointee to one of the public seats on the Commission on Judicial Conduct. The Commission's role is to make sure judges uphold judicial ethics, preserving public trust in the court system. Anyone can file a complaint if he or she believes a judge acted improperly. Unfortunately, many complaints are dismissed because they are about disagreements with a judge's ruling rather than misconduct under the Alaska Code of Judicial Conduct. The Commission cannot intervene if the question is about what a judge decided or ruled on any other issue in the courtroom. A complainant must instead file an appeal, which many who come before the Commission cannot afford to do so. As someone not trained in the law, I am often frustrated in my public position because I can do nothing about what I think is a poor ruling or even a poor decision. Many of these complainants who are denied feel justified in saying the judicial system is corrupt, unfair, biased, etc. They feel wronged, and I often feel they are justified in these feelings. My fellow commissioners often hear me questioning, why is a complaint ruled non-judicial and not considered? As the body that helps provide money to the court system, you all should be aware of how often these complainants are represented by public defense lawyers who have more clients than any reasonable person could handle, and way too little time to represent their clients effectively. Or these complainants represent themselves and don't understand the distinction between judicial complaint, for example, bias or discrimination, conflict of interest, improper behavior in or out of court, and the non-judicial complaints, which are not an issue addressed by the Alaska Code of Judicial Conduct, nor under the Commission's purview. As a member, I spend a great amount of time listening to audio of courtroom events, reading court documents, records, reading what complaints alleged transpired in their situation, hearing audio testimony from complainants, and able to ask questions directly of them. There are people who believe that we should allow them to these people to be present when we investigate what a judge is being accused of, but we are required to be confidential until such time as an investigation reveals misconduct is suspected. At that point, the commission holds formal hearings, allows the judge to respond, and reviews all testimony under oath. The commission does discipline Alaska judges when misconduct is proven. Unfortunately, investigation takes time, and due to the commission's generally 4 meetings per year, it can be months before a complainant hears that anything has transpired on his or her filing, which leads to complaints that the commission is doing nothing, but that isn't true. Finding misconduct by a judge is a very serious matter to the commission, and there are relatively few instances where the commission finds misconduct. Still, it reflects badly on the public's perception of the court system as a whole. As a side note, while I'm not particularly fond of the makeup of the Judicial Council that sends names to the governor for judicial appointments, I would hate to see us directly electing judges like so many other states do. The reports on judicial behaviors from Judicial Conduct Commission in those other states makes me cringe in disbelief. We just don't see that kind of judicial behavior complaints come before the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct, and that's because we don't elect our judges to office. Any questions?
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much for coming. And this you've been nominated for your second term on the Judicial Conduct Commission.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Oh, Senator Tilton. Do you have a question for?
She's off. I'll wait. No problem.
Okay. Next up, we have here in the room Jane Moores. Ms. Moores, if you would please come forward, put yourself on the record, and you may begin your testimony. And I'll assure members of the committee that she didn't fly down from Anchorage.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Klayman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jane Steiner Moores, and I do appreciate the opportunity to come before you today as a resident of Juneau here and as someone who was reappointed by the governor to serve as an attorney member on the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct. Since my professional background has been provided in my resume, I don't have a whole lot of prepared remarks, but I do want to say I came to Alaska as a teenager and have been a member of the Alaska Bar and have practiced law in Alaska for more than 35 years. Most of that practice has been in Southeast Alaska. Over the course of my career, I have aspired to maintain the highest ethical standards in my own practice of law. Ethical conduct is not only important to me personally, but it's important to the legal profession as a whole. And the same is true for our judicial system. My interest in continued service on the commission really comes down to earning and maintaining the public trust in Alaska's well-respected judicial system. Alaska judges are held to very high ethical standards of conduct, and public trust in our system depends on accountability if and when a judge's conduct falls below those standards. The work of the commission to provide oversight of judicial conduct is critical to the public trust that in turn is essential to any healthy, well-functioning, and effective judicial system. I can report to you that the 9-member commission here in Alaska works very well together and we take our work very seriously. I'm committed to its mission and would be honored to continue my service as an attorney member of the commission. Thanks very much.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to ensure, as we have the responsibility of confirming that the statutory stipulations are met, you've been practicing in Alaska for more than 10 years, I am under the assumption. Yes. And are you currently still practicing law?
Yes, I am. Yes to both questions through the chair. Senator Tobin.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few questions and might have to do with that I don't have a lot of experience with the Judicial Conduct Council, but if you could help me kind of answer some of those. When a complaint is received, what is the process to be sure that it is being looked at impartially?
Well, I think that everyone that through the chair, Senator Tilton, I think everyone is very committed to impartiality. And since all the years I've been on it, I've never seen anything that even suggested partiality by the executive director or the commission members. Mm-hmm. Every single complaint that comes in is reviewed. And we review, the commission members review it too. So it's taken in by staff and the executive director and reviewed.
Okay.
And court records are looked at. And then by the time it comes to us, there's usually jurisdiction. What are recommended is jurisdictional and non-jurisdictional kinds of complaints. That's kind of the first cut. Because we do get a lot of non-jurisdictional complaints. We get a lot of complaints from people that aren't happy with the decision. A decision that could have been appealed or should have been appealed. Because they may not be right. We might not agree with the decision, but we have very limited jurisdiction. We can't do anything about a decision that someone disagrees with. So we really are limited to looking at the conduct and behavior. So that usually does involve sometimes listening to tapes, you know, that kind of thing. But the jurisdictional, non-jurisdictional is the first cut. And then staff does an enormous amount of heavy lifting when it comes to researching these and providing the packets we get for our quarterly meeting are significant. Take hours and hours. but no action is taken by anyone on a complaint but through the commission. The commission takes the action. So whether it's a non-jurisdiction or proceeding forward on a jurisdictional, it's all done by the commission by vote.
Thank follow you.
Can I, yeah. Senator Tilton.
Yeah, maybe not so much a follow-up, but if there is a difference of opinion in the institutional, like an institutional conflict where somebody might have a difference of opinion with a judge or something like that, or there's any safeguards that can protect that individual making that complaint if it's about a certain judge or something like that. I mean, I'm not sure how the process works.
I'm not sure if I understand, through the chair, Senator Tilton, I'm not sure if I understand the question. You mean with they don't,
so maybe let me just restate it. If they feel like there's some allegations of institutional misconduct, is there anything that safeguards that person from that? If they're making those kind of allegations, and is there any way that it, how can it be heard besides through the conduct council if it maybe is subject to somebody who, I guess I'm having a hard time expressing what I'm trying to say, but
let me. Are you asking about misconduct in the frame of the institution has certain practices that somebody's unhappy with the way the practices work, but it's not really doesn't make a distinction between any individual. Like everybody has to file their complaint by a certain date.
Sure.
Or are you asking about specific behavior by a judge?
No, I think if there's specific behaviors and the public feels like institutionally that they did not that. They're not being heard regarding these specific behaviors. What kind of remedy do they have?
Well, I'm going to try to peel back a couple onions. First,
sorry.
I should mention, too, that we do get a group of complaints oftentimes where it's more of a complaint about a lawyer than a judge.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be something in someone's case that maybe they don't, the judge could have handled, I mean, the lawyer could have handled differently, or they may have a claim against the lawyer to the bar. That would be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If there is, you know, sometimes there can be procedural fixes that when you talk about institutionally, let's say if something drops off a calendar and it's not timely processed, because that's one thing we look at too. So sometimes those can be handled by the chair or someone talking to the presiding judge and making those kind of fixes, because that could have some kind of a institutional effect if it's that kind of thing. The most we can do is ask the complainant. If we don't feel like we have enough information, sometimes we have to go back and try to get more information, because we really do try to take whatever information we have and pursue it. And even if they're not wording it exactly right, if we think they're trying to, you know, we will pursue it, but we do have to have some information. So in other words, if someone complains about a judge but provides no specific hearing or hearing date, it's very hard to us to research.
Mm-hmm.
did that judge behave in that hearing? So we have to be able to get that. You know, it's an evidence-based kind of process too, because judges have rights. So we do really try to drill down and find the evidence and turn over the rocks. And sometimes we find it and sometimes we just don't. And I'm not sure that I'm really answering your question, but usually if it's a systemic thing, it's going to be more than one judge. And so there's going to be specific information or evidence tied to that judge that can be pursued and investigated.
Okay. No, I appreciate it. And considering how clear my question was, I appreciate your answer.
And just as a note to those that don't recognize, this is former Senator Hughes's sister. Anyway, welcome. And my query, I'm thinking this is your third, is this your third appointment to the Judicial Conduct Commission or your second appointment?
This is, through the chair, Clayman, yes. This is my second full-term appointment. I was appointed to finish a term 2019-2020 and then 1 4-year term from 21 to 24, and this is the third.
So there was a partial term, and now this is your reappointment to the second full term, but technically your third term if you count the partial term.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for coming today. Last up, we have Donald McClintock. Mr. McClintock, if you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone as the sound is not as clear. And please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Clayman and members of the committee. My name is Donald William McClintock. I am currently an attorney member of the Commission on Judicial Conduct. I've been a practicing lawyer in Anchorage for approximately 45 years. It's sort of shudder to admit that, but and during that time, I've enjoyed, I think, the benefits of what I consider a very superb bench that Alaska has had really throughout the years, and I appreciate the opportunity to serve on the commission to further preserve the integrity and reputation of the judges who practice in front of our court. I don't really have, I really appreciated the comments by Commissioners Moores and Kilbourn. I don't need to add or repeat those, but I'm certainly happy to take any further questions that the committee may have.
Don't. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McClintock, similar question. To ensure that you meet the statutory and stipulations for reappointment to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, have you been practicing law in the state of Alaska for 10 years, and are you currently a practicing attorney?
I am currently a practicing attorney, and yes, I have practiced for more than 10 years.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much. I do have a question. I know this is not your first appointment to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. How many terms will this be if you're confirmed?
Oh, thank you. Yes, through the chair, this will be my third term, which would end, technically start in 2025 and would end in 2029.
Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McClintock, I'm kind of trying to absorb all of the process that you have. So when you have a complaint that is made and there's an investigation, in the process of that investigation, are the public allowed to participate in those? I heard Ms. Adine talk about that there was some confidentiality. So where is the line of how much the public is allowed to participate in those investigations?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Tilton. It is we follow a procedure that's common to pretty much all of the judicial conduct commissions, which is when a complaint is filed and initially researched to see if it's within our jurisdiction, the matter is confidential. The judge is not told about it. It's certainly not released to the public. And we basically undertake the investigation in a quiet way. And a very common issue, for instance, is it's a violation of ethics, of course, for a judge to exhibit bias. Virtually every complaint that comes in starts with the line that the judge is biased against me. And one of the things that we have to do is look through the record and determine, well, is this because the judge ruled against me, which isn't necessarily the type of bias that the code refers to, or is it, or are there specific acts or incidences that could give rise to a further indication of bias? So this is done by looking at the record, looking at the transcripts, listening to the recordings, specifically any information that the complainant can give to us to research. And again, that is all kept confidential. At the point that the investigation and the staff comes to the commission and says, well, we really haven't found any conclusive evidence of or indication of bias, the commission will then look at that and either ask the executive director and staff to go back and ask for more detailed information, or will agree that, yes, it's not jurisdictional and dismiss it. At that point, everything is confidential. Nothing is released to the public. Nothing is released to the judge. At the point that the staff and then the commission agrees that there is something here that actually merits investigation, at that time, we notify the judge that the investigation is ongoing. We will more actively seek wider information. And in that sense, it's the confidentiality is less, how do you say? I mean, you are talking to other members of the court, perhaps other litigants or other people. So it's not a breach of confidentiality in the sense of it's being announced, but you are conducting an investigation. People can learn that there's an investigation going. It's not until that process is concluded and all the materials in front of the commission, and the commission says there is enough here to make a finding of probable cause that we believe there's been a violation of the judicial ethics. And at that point, there's public notice given. And there's also an opportunity at that point for other information from the public to come in, which has happened in the past. So I think that's hopefully answers your question, but that's probably the point where the transition from a confidential proceeding to a more public proceeding happens, is the determination of probable cause.
Senator Tilton.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. McClintock, for the answer. Along this timeline that you've talked about, how much involvement then is the complainant have? Are they make their complaint and then are they having any conversations with the council, or is that their complaint and then, you know, we're not having discussion with them until we get to that public process?
Before it even reaches the commission, staff has been good about reaching out to the complainants and asking them for additional materials. Obviously, a lot of the complainants, you know, aren't trained to file complaints, so they are provided the opportunity to sort of bolster their with material so that we have something to review and staff has something to review. If, for instance, a decision is made that the complaint is non-jurisdictional and not within, sort of our purview, they are given an opportunity to speak to the commission the day that the commission considers whether to dismiss it as non-jurisdictional or not. So, and we've seen files where people had submitted several different tranches of materials during the proceedings. So I would like to think that there's multiple opportunities for that sort of input, and obviously welcome anything that would improve access to the commission. I think, as Commissioner Kilborn said, I mean, we very much, I think, are committed to making sure that the public feels that their concerns are being heard and evaluated as best we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any further questions. Thank you very much, Mr. McClintock. Seeing no other questions, we're going to open public testimony on the appointees to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. I only see Ms. Moores in the room, so I assume there is no one else in the room, no one in the room that would like to provide public testimony. But I do see we've got a couple online. Betty Jo Moore. Ms. Moore, if you would identify yourself for the record, and you've got 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Betty Jo Moore. I live in Senator Tobin's district in Anchorage. I represent myself. Let the record also show my written testimony. The Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct, ACJC, members need to have term limits of not more than 2 terms. I've attended several ACJC meetings, and this commission is not functioning to enhance justice for all Alaskans. Is the ACJC considered an independent agency within the judicial branch? Ms. Greenstein writes in a published article that typically judicial conduct commissions created by state constitutions are considered independent agencies within the judicial branch. Is this true of the ACJC? Is or should Governor Dunleavy, with his executive power and authority as written in Article 3, Sections 1 and 16, charged by his oath oversee the ACJC members that function as the judge of judges? The Alaska Bar Association has ultimate control over the initial review and selection of judges, not we the people. Solution, all justices and judges should initially be elected by the people for the people. I have been writing and making public testimony for several years identifying serious issues within the judicial system that need to be corrected to ensure justice is for all Alaskans. Today, judicial reform has not happened. The American legal system has and is not working for all Alaskans. There needs to be new members appointed to the ACJC with term limits. I do not support members seeking more than 2 terms to the ACJC. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. Next in the queue, we've got Ed Martin. Mr. Martin.
Yes, Chairman Klayman and members of this very important committee on the judiciary, something that functions.
Please identify yourself. Please identify yourself, please.
I'm sorry. My name is Ed Martin, Jr. I reside in Kenai, Alaska, and I represent myself, my family, and my great-grandchildren at this point because they don't know what they're coming into in their lives. And I hope they never have to get into a judicial, in any kind of fashion, the judicial system as it exists today. Senator Klayman, I have no personal vendetta against any of these people, but I have been in front of them for over 4 years now with a simple request about whether or not our public officials, including them, should be bonded under Alaska statutes and or Supreme Court Order 10. I've been made into a liar by Judge Ropeman. I've been further dismissed by Mr. McClintock himself and invited to come and testify in front of the whole committee where I was summarily dismissed on Zoom, registered. This is not the kind that builds confidence in our judge of judges. These people are self-serving, they protect each other, and I know very well each and every one of them, except for Mrs. Soares. But I can tell you right now, if they're protecting each other from the unethical actions of their committee, then who checks them? This is really out of control, Chairman and members of this committee. You must investigate what is going on in their committee, and particularly the last commission meeting, of which I couldn't control my anxiety enough to get to speak. And I hate to call myself somebody that is handicapped, but you know something? My passion is in following the law.
Mr. Martin, you're at the 2 minute mark. Mr. Martin, you're at the 2 minute mark. If you could conclude your remarks, that'd be great.
All I'm going to ask of you folks is do your due diligence. Check out the last meeting. Do not forward these names until you have done that. And then the current complaint is against several judges, including Judge Amy Mead.
Thank
That's
you
all very, I ask of you, and God bless you and your mission.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else online. I see no one in the room for public testimony, and we're going to close public testimony. Any final comments from members of the committee? Hearing and seeing none, Senator Tobin may have a motion. I've been calling on Tilton all day.
The Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees and recommends that the following names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Alden Kilbourn, Donald McClintock III, and Jane Morris for the Commission on Judicial Conduct. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against the individuals during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Thank you. The names will be forwarded to the joint session. We're not going to take a brief eddies. We're going to adjourn, and please stay after to sign the paperwork. We are adjourning for the day. Our next meeting will be on Friday, April 17 at 1:30 p.m. And with that, we stand adjourned. The time is now 2:25 p.m.